Welcome to the Amateur Traveler Podcast, episode 54. Today we go on an adventure to Latin America. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Before we go to Latin America, I have a few news stories for you. The first one is of a personal nature. I am starting up a third podcast, the Amateur Traveler being the number one podcast, the Amateur Traveler Video Edition being number two, and the third one will be a short podcast for the podcaster network, news network called Amateur Traveler Brief, which will be shows of 2 to 5 minutes long. So you might want to check that out on the Podcast News Network. I'll put links to that in the show notes at amateurtraveler.com. In other news, you may have seen that smart passports were rolled out in the United States on August 14th. These are the controversial new passports that embed an RFID chip that can be read remotely. And the controversy arises from some security experts saying that that chip can be read by other people not belonging to the Customs Service. The next news story comes from the BBC. At least 10,000 bags checked into British Airways passengers have gone missing at the airports since the UK began its security alert last week. So if you're traveling through Heathrow, don't be too surprised if you arrive at your destination without your luggage. They're still sorting things out with all of the extra bags since people are still not allowed to have carry-on luggage. In the final news item from the CBS News, if you are missing the pair of scissors or the pocket knife that you had confiscated from you at the airport, you might be able to buy it on eBay. At least one airport is selling all the confiscated items at auctions on eBay. Links to all those news stories at the show notes at amateurtraveler.com. I titled this episode Latin America Adventure, and you'll see why the word adventure is very appropriate in this interview from Kinsey from the Findy Time podcast. I'd like to welcome Kinsey on the show, who wrote me about a trip he took to Latin America. Kinsey, welcome to the show.
Hi, Chris.
So you took an interesting trip for 97 days touring around Latin America.
Yes. Not actually around, but actually starting in Indiana and then ending in Brazil.
And Muncie, Indiana is not generally considered part of Latin America, so how long till you got down to Latin America?
Well, not very long at all. I just I took a Greyhound from Muncie to the Brownsville, Texas, which is the border with Mexico, and that took, I'm sure it didn't take more than 24 hours.
And what led you... Why this trip? What led you to go for that long and to those particular places?
Well, I'm very familiar with Brazil. At the time, I'd lived in Brazil over different periods, over maybe about 3 years, and I knew Portuguese, and I had a lot of friends there, and I had just finished one job, so I was between jobs, and I was going down to Brazil to visit my friends and to work on my Portuguese a bit. And since I had all this extra time, I thought it would be interesting. I really barely knew any Spanish at all, but I thought it would be interesting to go over land because, I mean, technically where I live, Indiana, is connected by land to where I spent all that time in Brazil. So I thought it would be interesting to see the transition as I passed from one country to another.
And you went through, and I think you sent me the list of countries, Mexico, Guatemala, Belize, Honduras, Nicaragua, Costa Rica, Panama, Colombia, Ecuador, Peru, and Bolivia.
Yes.
So you traveled by all sorts of different means of transportation.
Yes, my goal was to keep the trip completely over land. So there was only one place coming out of Panama where I had to cheat a little and go on a boat for 15 minutes over around the coast. But that was just 15 minutes, so it wasn't too bad.
Of the whole trip, what stands out? I mean, what were the highlights? You covered a lot of ground here.
Well, I suppose the most interesting part was the Darien Gap, which separates Panama from Colombia. It's an 80-mile stretch where there are no roads, there's no infrastructure. You reach the town of, I think it's Yavisa in Panama, and there's no more road. You just go into a jungle, and it's there are many indigenous people living there in their traditional lifestyle, and you just have to hike and ride on dugout canoes, and it took me a total of 10 days to get through there.
Now, that can't be the only route that you can take, so you chose to go that particular route, because the Pan American Highway also goes through there.
No, actually, it doesn't.
Oh, it doesn't? Okay.
No, there are a lot of misconceptions about it. Some people think it goes all the way. Some people think it stops, but they think it stops at the canal and doesn't go over the canal. But, yeah, actually, there is 80 miles, and the only way it can go overland is going through that undeveloped area.
I would be one of those people who had the misconceptions that it went the whole way. Oh, wow.
I think it's considered the Pan American Highway, the part that goes through South America, but there is a gap in it.
Huh. You say that part stands out, and it stands out. It sounds like that was also part of the most rugged part of the trip?
Yeah, there was, as I said, there's no infrastructure, and I even had a bit of culture shock as I got deeper and deeper into it. On my second or third day, well, transportation there is mostly through this river that just winds all over the place, and it's really slow going. And the Indians who live there have, I've never seen this before, it's like a portable outboard motor that you can strap to a dugout canoe. So they hook it to the back of the canoe, and then when they reach where they're going, they pick it up and take it into their house or their hut with them. About my second day there, the fellow, he didn't even look necessarily indigenous, but then when I got to spend the night where he lived with his extended family, it was in a treehouse. Everything has to be in a treehouse because the water level fluctuates so much. Yeah, well, the thing that really surprised me, besides the fact that I was in this I don't even know quite what words to use. I don't like to use non-civilized or tribal but it was so remote from Western civilization that the women there were all bare-breasted. There are two Indian tribes in that area. One is the Kuna, and the other is the Choco. And the Choco women don't wear tops. So I was in this treehouse, and all the women were topless. And it was just really weird and different from anything I'd experienced before. But they were all very nice people.
Any other big surprises on the trip?
Well, everything was a surprise. I had taken a stack of Lonely Planets with me, which I read every day and planned ahead. But there were all, I guess, the biggest surprise that stands out is when I was in a bus going down the coast of Peru on this long, like 20-hour bus trip, and I woke up when the sun was down, and there were all these dunes that I didn't know anything about. I guess I had missed that in my Lonely Planet, and it just went on for hundreds and hundreds of miles. I also went through the region between, well, mostly in Brazil, but a little bit in Bolivia, called the Pantanal, which is a really interesting natural area. It used to be millions of years ago, there was an ocean that is mostly dried out, and it's left a swamp. And you can see, you can see for miles because there aren't any large trees growing in the way. And I went through there in a bus, and I saw lots of animals. Even riding on a bus on the interstate, I even saw an alligator. And there are these capybaras, which are the largest rodent in the world. They're like as big as a sheep, and there were herds of them all over the place. And they're really cute. And if I had wanted to, I could have taken a tour very cheaply and really gone out there with someone who knew the area and could show me all sorts of things. And once again, I was in such a hurry to get where I was going that, you know, and I didn't want to do the touristy thing. But now I really wish I had, and I'll probably never get out there again.
How about, are there any places along the way that you couldn't pay you good money to go back to?
Let's see. Well, there were some, not so much countries, although I did skip El Salvador. I went around it rather than through it because I couldn't, there was nothing interesting in the guidebooks about it. But places, well, port cities, I was originally going to try to get to Brazil through the Amazon, and I was at a port city where I was supposed to get a boat, and I couldn't get a boat. And it was a lot like, I'm sure you've seen Star Wars on Tatooine and in the bar. It was exactly like that. not the bar, but I mean the whole place. Like, I guess that I hadn't realized there were real places like that, but apparently, I mean, that is a plus where they went to get a ship with Han Solo, and I guess that's based on reality, and it's dangerous, and things are overpriced, and you just feel really uncomfortable and at risk there. And I went through two cities, well, two towns like that, and I would really avoid them if at all possible in the future. I don't remember what their names were, though.
But they were on the ports on which coast?
They were river ports, not
river
ocean ports.
Okay.
Well, no, one was an ocean. Oh, yeah, the city of Colon, which wasn't too bad. That's on the, if you go down the canal from the Panama side to the other side, to the I think to the Atlantic side, that's a port, and that wasn't very pleasant, but it wasn't too bad. Although from my hotel window, I could see like a prostitute out there the whole night working, trying to find clients and things. So it was. I mean, it wasn't a really pleasant place to be, and the other place was, I think it was on the, it was somewhere, it was more inland, it was on the Putumayo River, I think, in South Colombia, which flows, I think, into the Amazon, but I may have that wrong.
Okay.
And that was a really bad place.
Of all the countries you went to, did the people in any particular country just really stand out for you that, gee, if you ever had to go back and live, these are the people you'd want to be with?
Let me see. I think the people in Peru were really nice. I'm not sure I could, although I'm not sure I would ever be able to be close friends with them because the cultures are so different. I don't know if I would ever fit in there. But from what I see, I think they were the nicest people that I came across.
And what sort of things were different culturally?
You mean in general in different countries?
In general. Well, you say that between you and the people of Peru, you felt there was a culture gap there. What kind of things were different?
It's hard to explain. Just I wasn't at all familiar with their culture, and I didn't know any. It's very, I guess it's a very indigenous, and it didn't have a Western feel to it.
Okay.
So it would take me, I guess, some time to, I don't know, I mean, maybe if I settled in there, I would all, after a few months, I would be very comfortable, and they'd know me, and I'd know them, and everything. But I felt that they were very, very nice people. I just don't know if I would ever be more than an outsider there.
Mm-hmm. Was there, you were gone for 97 days, was there a point at which you were the low point, you were ready to hop a plane and go back to Muncie?
Not really. I guess I've heard a lot of travel stories where people reach that point. I guess the closest I came was in Colombia after I had gone through the Darien Gap, and that was kind of, some parts of that were very scary. And I, you know, I'd finally gotten to a big city and I was rested and I was just kind of, I don't know, I was just sort of opening my eyes for the first time and I'm like, what on earth am I doing? I mean, I don't even speak Spanish, and here I am in Colombia. How did that happen? And I just sort of had to, I don't know quite what was going on in my mind, but I just sort of, that was sort of a transition point for me in the trip, but I figured, well, I've already gone through the hardest part, and if I've made it this far, I can easily get to Brazil, and I did. But yeah, I guess that was my, I don't know if it was a low point, it was just strange.
And did you pick up much Spanish along the way? You say you didn't really go with much Spanish.
Yeah, I had had a 101 college class in Spanish, but actually, if you know Portuguese, all you have to do to speak Spanish, at least to be understandable, is alter your pronunciation in certain ways, which are very simple, and then substitute a few of the, like, if you know maybe 100 of the most common words in Spanish and substitute them into Portuguese and pronounce what you're saying like Portuguese, it practically becomes Spanish. So I got pretty good at doing that by the end of the trip.
Any points at which the language barrier led to unexpected consequences, or?
Not that I can think of.
Okay. You had at least one wildlife encounter along the way that you mentioned on your podcast, and I didn't mention that you have a podcast. That I should have mentioned that at the first part of the show. You want to? Here's your chance to plug your podcast first, and then maybe you'd tell us the story about. Well, I don't want to give it away.
Are you talking about the tarantula?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah, my podcast is Tvindy Time, spelled T-V-I-N-D-Y, time, and you can find it at tvindytime.com. Yeah, this was in the Darien Gap. I was I actually encountered more than one tarantula there. I think I reduced the story down to just the main tarantula. I see what you mean about giving it away.
there's always editing here.
Okay, well, I was in the hut in, I think it was the town of Paya, which is the biggest but most isolated settlement in the Darien Gap, and I was in this hut. It was like a Gilligan's Island style hut, and everyone
in it was a communal hut. I think you said.
Yes, it was a communal hut, and everyone there slept on hammocks, and I read that in my Lonely Planet, so I came prepared. I had purchased a hammock in Mexico, and so I was all set there with my big hammock, and when I was sleeping, I felt something, and there were a lot of insects and things. I don't know if I thought it was a moth or whatever, but I felt something like kind of fluffy on my chest, so I batted it away like it was an insect, but it didn't feel quite right. So I pulled my pen light out of my pocket and I shined it on it, and I didn't even know where to look, but then I saw above my head there was this good-sized tarantula right above me. And
when you say a good-sized tarantula, now for me, good size would be really small. How big was this tarantula?
Let's see, maybe, I'm trying to figure out in inches, maybe 3 inches. They're all about the same size in Latin America, though, so. But yeah, it was much bigger than spiders we get here in the U.S.
Uh-huh.
And it was above me, and these hammocks, the Yucatan hammocks, are different than, like, in the U.S., we have them, but a lot of hammocks we have a board at the top and bottom, so it's like a platform that you sleep on, whereas this is something that just curls up and around you, so there was no way I could get away from it. And while I'm sitting there trying to think what to do, apparently, since I'm shining a light on it, it's casting a spider-shaped silhouette, and I hear a little boy shouting in his native language, which was Kuna. I didn't understand the words, but I'm sure he's shouting that, oh no, there's a tarantula in bed with the gringo. And so then everyone jumped out of their hammocks, and they all, you know, clustered around me, and they were shouting and telling me that's dangerous and it's poisonous, and I mean, they were not really being helpful at all. And I mean, I know that it's dangerous. and I assumed that, I mean, these are people who lived with tarantulas all the time. I mean, since I had all, you know, this was my second or third tarantula sighting, so I assumed they must know. I mean, they must deal with this all the time, and they sleep in hammocks. They must understand, like, the procedure for dealing with this. So I told them all to calm down, because they were all shouting at the same time. I wanted them to calm down so they do whatever it is you do. And I said, everyone, just calm down. I said, todos se calmense. And they immediately, everyone just stopped talking in mid-sentence, and there was, like, silence. And so I'm like, finally. And then they just stood there, like I had taken control of the situation, and they were looking to me for leadership, and like they were willing to do whatever I said to help me get rid of the tarantula, but I don't know what to do. And so you know, and then they started, you know, telling me again how dangerous it was. And so what I finally did, and it's really scary, because whatever you do, you can't, I mean, just about anything you do would cause the tarantula to fall on, well, it would fall on my face. So what I did is I just started rolling to the right as the tarantula was on my left side. So I was rolling to my right until I had rolled out of the hammock, and then the hammock acted as a slingshot, and the tarantula shot up in the air, and then there was this big tarantula hunt as everyone tried to find it, and it took them a very long time to find it. And I don't know if I said on my podcast, but the next morning when I was putting on my shoe, there was something blocking where I put my toes in, so it was a really tight fit. So I pulled my foot out of my shoe, and another tarantula of the same size came running out of the shoe. I'm surprised it didn't bite me while my foot was in there. And and so I pointed it out to the people who were around me, and they ran after it and killed it. And they were kind of surprised. They're like, "Wow, that's two tarantulas for you in 2 days." And I was like, "Yeah, I guess that's not common."
Food. You went through all of this area. What did you like?
Well, actually, it was kind of tough for me because I'm a vegetarian.
Ah, okay.
So I didn't encounter. When I was in cities, I would eat as much as I could whenever I found a vegetarian restaurant. There was a really good one near the Zocalo in Mexico City where I ate enough to last me for practically a week after that. And in Costa Rica, they have Hare Krishna restaurants, which are like the Krishnas are the ultimate vegetarian cook. So I had a really good meal there. But mostly, just traveling around, I would maybe eat some fruit or bread or beans, but nothing really spectacular. Oh, and of course on the island of Apila, I had fish and lobster and things like that.
And of all the sights you saw, what sights really stand out for you?
I guess what really stands out, well, the dunes I talked about, but also the Darien Gap. It had a very remote kind of feel. It was being in pristine wilderness, completely separated from infrastructure, and going by dugout canoe through areas where even there weren't even any indigenous inhabitants, and just seeing it's hard to really explain what that's like. And I've been to national parks in Alaska where I'm out by myself, and I didn't have that feel because you occasionally come across a piece of litter or a plane flies overhead, and that sort of spoils it. But out there, it was just, I mean, I practically expected to see dinosaurs come out of the forest. It was really incredible.
And did you, the whole time you were by yourself, no traveling companions?
Yeah, I was by myself all the way. Whenever I take a trip like this, there are always a bunch of people who are really interested at first, and then as it gets closer and closer to the date, people back out for different reasons. And so I've learned to never depend on people's promises to come along.
Okay. Any other highlights of the trip? If someone was going to follow in your footsteps, what should they know? What should they bring with them? What should they plan ahead of time?
Well, once again, the best thing they can do is stock up on as many Lonely Planet guides as they can. Of course, the problem is carrying those with you, they weigh a lot. And I mean, it doubled my weight because I had all these different country guides. But I can't see how I could have done it as well without them. So it was kind of a trade-off. Hopefully someday there'll be an ebook format for them. But, yeah, what would I recommend? I can't think off the top of my head, just basic. I guess one thing people might not think of is when you go through border crossings, they look at you to see if you look like you have enough money that they should let you into the country. Huh. And if you look disheveled and you're wearing shorts and a T-shirt, they'll ask to see your traveler's checks and your money and things. So, and Lonely Planet gives advice on this as well, that you should have like a change of clothes that makes you look wealthy, even if they're clothes that make you look ridiculous and extravagant and and like some stupid idiot millionaire who doesn't know what he's doing. They don't care if you're a stupid idiot. They just care if you look like you have money. So it's good to bring some like a tuxedo or something for when you get. That might be overdoing it.
This mental image of you walking into the jungle with a tuxedo, but
also some of the really cheap hotels, instead of locks, the door set up so you put a padlock on it. Most people don't think to take a padlock with them, and so they rent the padlock to you so you can lock your room. So take a padlock, and also like a rubber doorstop. If you don't feel secure in your hotel room, and maybe you don't even trust the management, and you don't feel secure, and you're traveling alone, you can wedge that under the door so no one can get in while you're sleeping. And those are the only things I can really think of.
And with the, did you stay in hotels most of the time then?
Yeah, hotels and hostels.
And hostels.
Definitely very low budget. I stayed in one. There was one in In Guatemala, it cost $2 a night, and that was not a really nice place.
So spend the extra dollar.
Yeah, that's one thing I learned. For $350, I could have stayed in a place where that had windows and a fan and was clean, and I could have had my own private bathroom. But no, I wanted to spend $2 rather than $350. And so I've learned when you travel, you should have some perspective on the amount of money you're spending. Don't be too thrifty.
Now, I don't generally hear of windows as being one of those optional things in a hotel, so $2 doesn't buy you very much hotel then in Guatemala.
No, and it was the temperature was in the 90s or even low 100s, so I was really suffering.
What time, you started in September, and you were doing this for almost 100 days, so you were going down there in the start, in early spring into summer.
Yeah.
Okay. And so was the weather hot and sticky the whole time? You were also in the Andes, so you had a great variety, I would think, of weather.
Yeah, the one thing that I really didn't work well, I knew this was going to be a problem beforehand, was that I went through the Darien Gap in the rainy season.
Oh.
And yeah, it was, in fact, I had two guidebooks, one that said that it's very difficult and you should avoid going through in the rainy season and you'll be absolutely miserable. Another guidebook said it's impossible to go through in the rainy season, but I did manage it, but the rivers were kind of problematic and I had to walk. The city that's the jumping off point, where you would normally take a bus and walk a few miles to get to the next city before you... I don't remember how it's set up exactly, but usually you'd have to walk a few miles to get to the last outpost before going into the jungle. But I had to walk something like 7 or 8 miles, and the road was so muddy, and you couldn't see where... there were holes filled with mud. You know, sometimes I would, if I was carrying a heavy backpack, sometimes I would sink down, all the way up to my hips in the mud. Yeah, even the bus was having a hard time driving through there. That's why it stopped early, I think. And people were criticizing the bus driver because the bus would at some points it felt like it would almost tip over. And the bus driver was explaining to the people that he was doing his best, but you just can't see where the muddy holes are because it looks like the ground. And I found that even when I got out and walked in it, even walking, you can't see where it is. So that was really an ordeal.
Oh, my. Okay, I was just telling my wife the other day that I hadn't found my limit on adventure yet. I think you've just mentioned it. Any other last tips for this trip as we wrap this up?
No, except that it's doable. A lot of people didn't think that I could do it or that it was doable. And it's actually, if you just take it step by step and don't think of it as a long journey, but plan ahead, and you just take one bus or one train from one city to another, and you don't have to do it completely overland. You don't have to go through the Darien Gap. You can skip that. So it's a trip that anyone could take.
Well, thanks so much for coming and sharing your adventure. I think we have to really classify this as an adventure with us.
Yeah, I hopefully will never have an adventure quite that big ever again.
Thanks, Kenzie.
Okay, thank you.
I think that interview turned out well, but it caused me a little bit of problems because we had about a 3-second delay in between my questions and Kenzie's answers that I had to cut out in post-production. We also dropped the call in the middle, and then I had portions of it that just didn't record, so it was a bit of a trifecta as far as technical difficulties on this, but I hope you enjoyed it anyway. I think hopefully it didn't show up in the final product. As we move on to internet resources, I do want to remind people again that I'm encouraging people to go to sendchristoireland.com and register to send yourself to Ireland, and also put a note in there that you really ought to send Chris along with you to go podcast from Ireland, and you'll see details at sendchristoireland.com. I got an email this week from Lorraine from the Home-Based Travel Agent podcast. She's the co-host on that. I had a chance to meet Lorraine a couple times. And she wrote about a recent question we had. Somebody had written recently to ask about a place where women can travel alone, and she pointed out that Globus, which is part of the Globus family group of companies, has one section that caters to single travelers and women. And she suggests the website, globusjourneys.com, and I'll put links to that in the show notes. I got an email this week from Lisa who wrote, "I'm so glad I heard this episode," writing about the Chicago episode last week. "I'm originally from Chicago area and I miss the food so much. Now I'm planning a trip back to take my children to just about all the places mentioned. I would throw in all the great museums on my trip also. Thanks for the cholesterol-free trip to Chicago taken from my laptop. Keep up the great work. My entire family loves this podcast, and I can't wait to take some of the trips you mentioned here. Thanks again." Thanks very much, Lisa, for your kind letter and encouraging letter. I do encourage people to share their comments on either the discussion boards at amateurtraveler.com/board or send me an email at host@amateurtraveler.com. I love to hear from people, and it certainly makes it easier to get the podcast out. That's going to do it for this show. I want to thank you all for listening, and I'm going to close this show with a promo for the Blueberry Network. I'm recently joined the Blueberry Network at blueberry.com, blubrry.com. So you might go over there and check out the other fine podcasts. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is part of the Blueberry Network, where listeners and podcasters come together. Find out more at blueberrywithnoes.com.
The best and the brightest served up daily by the sharpest minds in content delivery, Pod Show, and Limelight.